The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning I thought about talking about mindfulness and awareness and how we pay attention to our experience. So we cultivate mindfulness in our sitting meditation through bringing attention to our breathing, bringing attention to our experience in general. And the mindfulness practice in particular is not restricted or necessarily focused on any one experience. We come in and cultivate our attention on the breathing often as a place to begin. But with the mindfulness practice, we don't have to stay there. The mindfulness practice is about opening up to all of our experience and cultivating a steadiness of awareness on the changing nature of our experience. So, for instance, in this last sitting, I particularly found that at one point there was the leaf blower, the train, and a barking dog, you know, all at once. And it's like, you know, that's what the mind was doing. It wasn't, you know, it's not a problem. You're paying attention to the breathing, and the train comes, the barking dog, the leaf blower, all are just going at the same time, and the attention is pulled to hearing. So that's what we do. We don't try to struggle or fight to stay with the experience of breathing. If hearing is happening, we cultivate that continuity of awareness on hearing. So that's not particularly a problem. So we just cultivate our awareness on what is particularly obvious in our experience. And if there's any kind of a conflict or struggle, if we're using a kind of an anchor object or a primary object or some experience to cultivate that steadiness of attention, if something else becomes strong in our experience, the sound of the leaf blower or the sound of a motorcycle or a pain in the body or an itch or an emotion, whatever comes up, we allow that to be the experience that we attend to through the exploration of the body, through the exploration of what's happening in our minds. So we don't have to hold to one experience. We can allow the awareness to take in whatever is happening. One of my Burmese meditation teachers has written a book called Awareness Alone is Not Enough. And his name is Sayadaw Utejaniya. And that's a very interesting statement. And he says it a lot, that awareness alone is not enough. So the practice that I just described about just paying attention to what's ever obvious, that's the beginning. That's where we cultivate that stability of mind to be able to be with whatever is coming up. But often what seems to happen to us is that there are views or filters that we're seeing our experience through and we're not really aware of. So we might be frustrated, or we might be bored, or we might be excited. And we might not notice that boredom, excitement, or frustration as how we are looking at our experience. So we need a way, essentially, to uncover these views, to find out what are or how are the ways that we're seeing our experience. Now, why do we need to do this? Primarily because the views, the way that we see our experience, there tends to be some habitual ways that we operate. We have patterns or habits of operating out of aversive tendencies or wanting tendencies or perhaps kind of checked out tendencies, delusional tendencies. And these views or these tendencies or habitual ways of experiencing our world, if we are in our mindfulness practice seeing our experience through those same views, so for instance listening to the dog barking, you know, if there's an idea or an attitude or a view that shouldn't be happening, or that the person who owns the dog should control their dog, or something, you know, some kind of aversive tendency around experiencing that, then if we're not noticing that aversive tendency, that tendency is being reinforced. So we need to start uncovering these tendencies to kind of point out to ourselves, how are we observing? How are we looking at our experience? I'm going to get out a prop here. So, when we are looking through something, looking through a view of some sort, everything is colored by that view. And it's sometimes hard to notice that there's just that subtle, you know, different tone to experience. If you've got an aversive view that you're looking through, everything that your mind touches may be flavored by that aversive view. If you're not noticing that view, if you're not noticing that tendency, then that is being reinforced. So what we're trying to do here is to not just take off the glasses. I mean, we are trying to do that. But the movement is not one to get rid of them immediately, because we can't really do that. The movement is to pay attention to them. You know, instead of looking through them, look at them. So that we're no longer looking through that filter. So if it's aversion or something like that, what we do is we, instead of looking through that, when we notice that there's that aversive view, you know, paying attention to the dog and then there's this aversive experience, then we recognize, okay, aversion's happening, and we try to turn our attention to that aversion. Come on in. So we look at that aversion directly. This is a huge, powerful shift for us.
Sorry.
It's okay.
What's the last name?
Fella, F-E-L-L-A.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So this is a huge, powerful shift for us to, instead of looking through the experience, be looking at it. Instead of looking through anger, turn our attention. What does it feel like to be a human being that's angry? We can do that without aversion. It can be challenging. And sometimes, you know, in this process of uncovering these views, of uncovering these habitual tendencies, you know, we're looking through these glasses of aversion. And we know we're looking through the glasses of aversion, and we don't know how to take them off. But we know that we're looking through them. So it's kind of like we're still seeing everything in that way, but we at least know that that's how our mind is oriented. So we're not quite looking at the experience of the aversion. We're still looking through it, but we know we're looking through it. So we know that things are distorted a little bit in our experience. That's actually sometimes the first step. That's what we can do at that moment. So all of these explorations, what they do for us is they begin to help us to unmask these habitual views that we are operating through. So we need, or it's helpful to have some ways, some techniques to help us to discover what these views are. Sometimes it's like the ocean, you know, if there's a fish, you know, we're swimming in the ocean, and it's like the fish is not so aware of the ocean. Or us, you know, the breathing of air. Often we're just completely oblivious to air because it's just there, you know, it's so ubiquitous, it's just right there. We don't have to worry about it. And so sometimes these views that we have are that way. They are so familiar to us that we don't notice them. So we need some ways to begin to point out to ourselves that we are looking through those filters, those different colors of glasses. So this is essentially exploring how we relate to our experience. So there's what's happening. There's the barking dog, there's the itch, there's the feeling of vibration in the body, there's the moods in the mind, there's all of this stuff that's happening. And there is how we are relating to it. Essentially, as we pay attention to our experience, what is the quality of the mind that is paying attention? So how are we paying attention to the experience? So we need some ways to help us uncover how we are looking at our experience. In the meditation, it doesn't really much matter what we're paying attention to. It really does not matter what we're paying attention to. We have these ideas that we should be paying attention to the breathing, or we should be having certain kinds of experiences in meditations, or we shouldn't be having this experience in meditation. We have some ideas about this, but it really doesn't matter what we are paying attention to. But it is crucially important to track how we are paying attention to it. So the technique, or one technique that helps with this, is taught by this teacher that wrote this book, Awareness Alone is Not Enough. And it's a technique about checking, essentially checking what our relationship to our experience is. And this technique that he teaches actually uses a question to ourselves. What's my relationship to my experience? What's my attitude? He calls this view that we are looking through the attitude of our observing mind, the attitude of our awareness. So that's kind of a shorthand. What is my attitude? What's my attitude about what's happening? What's my relationship? How am I relating? Those are all fine ways to explore it. So the technique is basically very simple. In your meditation, you're sitting in your meditation or in your daily life. This technique is completely applicable also to our mindfulness practice in our daily life as we're going around our day. Occasionally, from time to time, checking in, well, what's my relationship to what's happening here? Am I frustrated? Am I angry? Am I excited? Am I bored? So in the sitting meditation also, we can do this. It's not something to do frequently. I mean, it's something to check into from time to time. And later I'll give you some ideas about particularly good times to check in to this after we've talked a little more about exploring this quality of the attitude. So it's that simple. You just ask the question, What's my attitude? What's my relationship to experience? You don't in that moment then try to figure out or think about what your attitude is. It's kind of more that the question is just opening the mind up to the possibility that something might be happening that it hadn't particularly noticed. So I kind of think of it as, you know, kind of ringing the doorbell of checking the attitude. You know, it's like you ring the doorbell, what's the attitude here? And then you wait and see what answers the door. So you don't have to think about it. Just ask the question. If nothing particularly comes to you, don't worry about it. Don't try to find an attitude. Don't try to figure out what it might be. Just continue with your meditation as it had been before. So you're paying attention to your breathing. You notice the sounds. You notice an itch. Check the attitude. What's your attitude? Nothing much is obvious to you. Just go back to breathing, noticing the breathing, etc. Just from time to time, check in. Sometimes these views, as I said, are so familiar to us, they are hard to see. So it may take a while for us to actually recognize that we're looking through gray glasses. I mean, we wear them all the time, you know. It's like, it's so normal to us that we're looking through gray glasses that when we check our attitude, it's like, well, this seems normal, so I don't particularly notice anything. That's fine. Don't worry about that. Just occasionally keep checking in. At some point, there will be a pretty obvious attitude for you. At some point, you know, you'll notice, boy, am I angry about this, or, oh, I'm so frustrated. So that at that point, it'll be really obvious to you. And so you don't have to actually try to find something if it's not clear. So that's the first point about asking this question and checking in. Just don't worry if you don't see anything obvious. At some point, there'll be something very clear. So when you do ask this question, as I said, you may not particularly find anything, but if there is something, it'll have roughly one of four flavors to it. You might experience something like, ooh, I want this to continue. You know, this is good. You know, this view, this is good, this is right. This is what's supposed to be happening, this kind of thing. This is a kind of an attitude of wanting things to be a particular way. It can have subtle flavors of perhaps anticipation, excitement, expectation. Those are kind of very subtle forms of this wanting attitude of mind. You might also experience the second flavor being one of not wanting. There's the obvious forms of that, of, boy, this is horrible, you know. I don't like this. This should go away. The feelings of anger, aversion, strong feelings of frustration, of just like this pushing away. Not supposed to be happening. That might be one of the flavors. The subtler forms of this attitude can include control, like wanting to control what's happening. The sense that, you know, something along the lines of, if I only pay attention to this properly, it will go away. So that kind of agenda, you know, a subtle kind of wanting to push away. There could also be the third flavor is basically delusion. And I'm going to hold off on going into that one because there's a lot to say about that. So I'm going to talk about the fourth flavor, which is often when I talk about this attitude of mind, people assume it means something that shouldn't be there. And there is a wholesome, skillful attitude of mind also, and that's one of balance, of calm, of peace, of acceptance, of equanimity. It might have the flavor. It can be really quiet. I mean, the balance of mind of equanimity has the flavor of something like, I don't mind this. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, I don't mind this. It's not got the flavor of, well, I don't care if this is happening. You know, that's got a subtle, you know, oh, I don't care. It's got a kind of a pushing away kind of attitude to it. So there can be, when you check in to the attitude, an acceptance, a feeling of acceptance, of calm, of balance. That is really helpful to notice. It's really helpful to notice because that means that you are looking at your experience with a clear mind, or as clear of a mind as you can touch into at that moment.
Was that the fourth one?
That's the fourth one, yes. So there's the wanting attitude, the aversive attitude, so the greedy attitude, the aversive attitude, the deluded attitude, and the balanced attitude. So those four flavors, basically, of attitude when you check in. And they'll have different levels or different levels of obviousness, and they can get very subtle. And when they get subtle, that's when they get a little harder to see. So don't worry about that. The practice is actually training our minds to uncover these more and more subtle attitudes. It's like we have many layers of glasses on, you know, from the dark, dark ones to the really, really light ones, to the completely clear ones that we're looking through and don't know that we're looking through. So the practice is about recognizing all of these different layers of these attitudes to the place where we get to the place where there's just this knowing without particularly any skew to what we are knowing. So I'm going to talk a little more detail about the attitude or the view of delusion. So delusion has a couple of different flavors to it. There's the delusion of kind of just not knowing, just kind of checked out, disconnected, what are some other words for that? Uncertainty, confusion, those kinds of things are flavors of delusion. Boredom can be a manifestation of a slight disconnection from experience. So boredom can be a manifestation of delusion. Boredom can also be a manifestation of aversion or greed. That, you know, it's like subtly we want something to be happening that's not happening. And because it's not happening, we're just a little bit bored. Or subtly we don't like what's happening. We're just, you know, it's like just a slight sense of this shouldn't be happening, and there's just a sense of boredom around that. So the boredom is kind of an interesting one. It can be out of any of them. It can be a response to any of those three kinds. So there's that kind of the delusion of just not being clear, just not knowing. Then there is the delusion of distortion. where it's back to the glasses. We're looking through something. We're looking through a colored glass. And because of that, there's a distortion to what we see. As I look through these, everything is darker. So there's a distortion to the perception. There are four fundamental ways that our perception is distorted. And all of these are hard to see. These really are the deeper layers of these views that are pretty clear. You know, that they're the kind of views that are, they seem like we're looking through our experience at truth. But there's actually a distortion. So there are four kinds of these this distortion. There is, the first one is seeing what is impermanent as permanent. Basically, we look at our world and we see things. We see, objects, we see houses, we see cars, we see people, we see things. And we impute a permanence to them. Now, an easy way or an interesting way to think about this, because there's a way in which we understand that things are not permanent. I mean, in our mind, we understand that things are not permanent. Intellectually, we understand they're not permanent. But we don't function that way. We don't actually function knowing deeply that they're impermanent. So, for instance, in our relationships with other people, we often have some view of who somebody is, you know, their personality, or what things they tend to do, what things they tend to not do. And our seeing of that person, when we see that person, we think of them in terms of that idea of that is how they are. We give them that, essentially, we impute a kind of a permanence to that, to them, based on that, those qualities. You know, we think, okay, they're always X. They're always late. They're always frustrated, they're always angry, whatever. We kind of impute a permanence to that. And we don't give them too much room to be different than that. Now, I think a lot of us have experienced this on the receiving end, you know, where we feel like we are being viewed through some filter that doesn't feel quite true. So that's kind of one aspect of it. You know, just that everything is a flow, everything is changing. And we don't really see things in that way. And there's a functional reason for it. I mean, it's useful to be able to act in the world in terms of objects and walking out there and seeing, okay, yes, my car is there and I can get in my car and drive away, and now, there's a usefulness to it, but we take it as reality. We take that idea that the things are there and permanent in a way as reality. So that's the first kind of distortion of perception, is seeing the impermanent as permanent. The second is seeing what is suffering as happiness. And this one is... Now, the way that we typically go about trying to find happiness in our lives is based on a pattern that we've learned as children, as adults over and over again, it's been reinforced to us that when we get what we want, it feels good. When we get rid of what we don't want, it feels good. So it's that we think that happiness is about constructing our world to meet our desires. Get rid of these things, more of these things, and to just continually be operating to try to construct our world so that it satisfies us, so that it suits us. And this view seems perfectly natural and normal to us. You know, that seems when we get what we want, we feel good. More of that, please. You know, I'll take more of those moments. When we get rid of what we don't want, there's a sense of, you know, control, of satisfaction that, yep, things are good now. But what that is doing essentially is keeping us tied to this wheel of having to keep doing things in order to arrange our environment. There's a quote, I might be able to remember it. It's a quote from a poem by Rilke. I'll paraphrase it. It's probably not going to be perfect. Something like, we are always looking outwards. We arrange the world. It breaks down. We rearrange it, then break down ourselves. So there's that continual sense of trying to arrange the world and just having to keep doing that. At some point it's like, enough already. You know, this is exhausting, trying to keep arranging the world. There's got to be a better way. So the most of us see, or before we come to some kind of a teaching that explains to us this process, that we're kind of caught on this cycle of having to keep doing, to fix, to change, to organize, to get, to have, that's actually suffering. It's suffering that we feel like we have to keep doing these things in order to arrange our world that way. So in that, we are seeing what is suffering as happiness. Because being tied to that, having to keep doing, keep rearranging, keep rearranging, keep rearranging, keep rearranging, we will break down at some point. At some point, it doesn't work. At some point, we can't rearrange things, and we discover often what we end up feeling like at that point is a failure. It's like, oh, well, I guess I'm doing something wrong. You know, this is not the way it's supposed to be. I'm failing somehow. Well, it's just the law of impermanence. That's all that's happening. It's not a failure. It's just the truth. And accepting that truth of impermanence is a huge place of shifting our perspective. The third kind of distortion of perception is around seeing what is not self as self. This can be a whole talk, so I won't try to go into it in detail. But basically this has to do with identification. That we identify with certain things, particularly habitually. We have certain things that we think are me, are mine, are who I am. I'm a miserable person. I'm a frustrated person. I'm a happy person. I'm the person who does this kind of thing. So we have these ideas, or this is mine. You know, this thing is mine. This house is mine. This car is mine. So we have some identification around what's happening. And through that, as a view. Essentially, you know, what we're doing to ourselves is the same thing that I just described that we often feel that others do to us. We're putting ourselves into a container and limiting our view of ourselves by having these identifications. You know, I'm a miserable person. I used to feel that way. I'm a miserable person. And pretty much everything I saw confirmed that fact. I'm miserable. I was really looking through these gray glasses. Everything is miserable. And there were moments when I was happy, moments when I felt good. But when I felt those, the feeling was kind of like, well, yeah, but I'm happy now. But, you know I'm really a miserable person. This happiness is impermanent. I knew the happiness was impermanent. I did not know the miserableness was impermanent. So that identification puts us in a box, limits us as to who we can be, who we can and what we can experience. There really isn't anybody there. That's not something you need to believe. It's something that is revealed to us as we explore the ways that we feel identity. So for me, you know, feeling this identity or looking, one of the practices I did around looking at identity is to look when that feeling of that identity is not there. Take that in. So taking in the fact that happiness is here. As you explore that, you begin to see actually that the permanent quality you had attributed for me to miserableness is not permanent. There are moments of non-misery. So it's like I look at it as kind of like, you know, taking in the other experience, or the when that pattern is not there, when that strong place, you know, if there's something exploring for yourself, if there's some pattern that you have a strong sense of, if that's me, that's who I am, noticing when that pattern is not there, it begins to poke holes into that identity. It starts you know, it's like you've got a piece of cheese and you're punching holes, you're making Swiss cheese out of it, and at some point that whole thing will fall apart. You know, that sometimes that pattern of miserableness will be there, and sometimes it's not there. And when that pattern of miserableness is there, it's like, oh, well, there's that pattern. That's happening right now. It'll go away. So the views like that are kind of, they're harder to see. Those kind are harder to recognize. Those are the ones that we hold very close to us. The last of the basic kinds of distortions of perception, of that kind of delusion, the distorted way we look at things, is seeing what is unbeautiful as beautiful. And this one is hard for us. The classic description about this has to do with the body, that we look at the body as beautiful or think it should be beautiful. I mean, how many of us suffer as we age and our bodies, you know, get spots and gray hair and, you know, wrinkles and all of those, you know, just the changing nature of the body. And if we think that the body is supposed to be beautiful, we'll suffer over that. And just looking outwards, even at bodies, one of my friends, who's a Dharma teacher, Heather Martin, pointed out that, you know, one of the things that we really like about bodies, what we like about bodies, you know, we like the way people's hair flows, you know, the gleam on their skin, kind of nice, you know, shape to nails, all of these things. And these are all the dead bits of our body. They're already the dead bits. You know? So It's kind of an interesting perspective on what we find beautiful. Another a way to think about it, Joseph Goldstein highlights this, and he talks about one time when he was having some kind of a medical procedure where he could watch on the camera what was going on inside of him. And, you know, as he was looking at that, I said, well, okay, yep, you know, is that me, my liver, my my intestines, is that me? But when we wrap it all up in skin, yep, that's me. So, you know, just kind of exploring what is it that you assume to be beautiful and start looking at it. Actually, what is this actually? What is this thing actually? So these delusions or distortions of perception, these are ones to, and it just, I give you this mostly as information and not so much as things to try to see. It's kind of, that's the kind of thing that we see almost as an insight, that we recognize, oh, this is impermanent. This is impermanent. You know, it's kind of like we're caught in the sound of something, and then suddenly it disappears. And it's like there's a surprise to that. It's like it points out to us that it's impermanent. And it points out the fact that we had assumed it was impermanent a moment before because of that kind of shock that happens as we recognize, oh, it's gone. It's gone. So we actually see that. So these kind of unmaskings happen more as we stay with our experience, as we just cultivate that continuity of awareness, just staying with the experience of breathing, hearing the sounds, experiencing the body, feeling the emotions, just being with what's flowing in our experience. The steadiness of attention, coupled with this occasional checking of the attitude. How am I relating to this experience? It's probably not that when you notice your experience, you might not notice, I'm relating to my experience as though it were permanent. That is going to be harder to see. So you don't have to try to do that. You don't have to try to recognize that. It will become clear to you at some point, just through that continuity. The continuity of awareness plus this occasional checking into the attitude to see, how am I relating to my experience? Is there greed? Is there aversion? Is there delusion? Is there balance of mind? Those two pieces together will begin to reveal and unmask these subtler forms of delusion. So there's some particularly good times to explore this attitude. You know, as we do our meditation or as we're in our day, wandering around and going shopping and working with people. If there's an experience of something's wrong, there's experience of tension, of frustration, of struggle, that's a good time to check the attitude. There's this experience of some kind of a conflict, whether it's with the coworker or with driving on the freeway or sitting on your meditation cushion. You're sitting on your meditation cushion and you're paying attention to your breathing, and the train goes by and the dog barks and there's a leaf blower and you think you need to stay with your breath, and there feels like there's a struggle there. There's some kind of attitude happening. Hearing is not meditation. Something like that, you know. There's nothing wrong with hearing as meditation. So if there's some kind of a struggle or conflict, check your attitude. You can just ask yourself that question. What's my attitude? So there's this tension, this struggle. What's my attitude? If there's a struggle or some kind of tension going on, it may be clear. There may be an obvious sense of, oh, I'm frustrated. Or, I want something. I want something. I want this freeway clogged up to go away. So So just recognizing, what is it that you want? Can you take it from being something you're looking through to something you're looking at? I want something. What does wanting feel like? When we recognize these attitudes, turning towards them, just the simply unmasking them through the recognition, through this checking, what's my attitude? Just even knowing that. As I said, sometimes you might be just knowing, okay, frustration. I'm looking at the world through frustration. And just know that, but still be looking at the world through frustration. Sometimes we can actually look at the frustration. What does frustration feel like? How does it feel in the body? How does it feel in the mind? Is there tension, tightness associated with the frustration? For looking at the frustration instead of through it, it's no longer running our experience. It's no longer manipulating us. It's like these attitudes, when they're not seen, they are making our choices for us. These attitudes are deciding how we respond to the world. If they're seen, if we can look at them, then we have the choice, or we begin to have a little more choice, because we're no longer being driven by those attitudes, we're observing them instead. So this movement, we can look at these attitudes of mind with a relatively clear mind. So we don't have to get rid of the frustration. We need to turn towards it so that we're not operating from the perspective of the frustration. Another good time to check into the attitude of mind is when you remember that you're paying attention, you know, that you're lost in thought, whether you're, you know, driving your car or grocery shopping or sitting on the meditation cushion. At some point you'll recognize, oh, I'm here. I'm paying attention. In that moment, when you come back, that moment of remembering, that's a good time to check the attitude. Because sometimes, it can go either way, actually. It can be that sometimes if we've been lost in thought, it's because we've been lost in some kind of a rant of some kind or other. And we come back and that rant is flavoring our experience. You know, so that's a good time to check in. You know, what's been happening? How has what has the being lost, how has that impacted my experience? Am I looking through some lens as a result of not being here? Sometimes when we come back from a wandering, actually it's interesting, and I find this particularly in meditation, that sometimes when I come back from a wandering, actually that wandering has not been particularly skewed at all. It's just been kind of relaxed, kind of almost a drifting, more of a light, it's almost like the concentration was there, but not quite enough energy to keep me present. And in the coming back, there's just a settledness. Sometimes that can be the case. And in that recognition of, oh, actually I'm pretty settled, pretty balanced in the coming back. So it's really helpful when you remember to check in. How has what's been happening impacted me? It may be that there's kind of a skew on the mind or a distortion of perception, or it may be that the mind has actually relaxed in that wandering. That's a good thing to know as well. A third time it's really helpful to check in to the attitude is when you feel like things are going really well. And you're having a really good sit, or you're really feeling like things are right in your life. Just check in and see, is there some kind of a tension or tightness around having to have that continue? It's not a problem to have things going well, but the addition of the wanting it to continue actually restricts that. It provides a... it doesn't allow that experience to be fully experienced or fully known if we are in that experience of feeling good, trying to figure out how can I keep this going for the rest of my life or the rest of this sitting or the rest of the day or even the next 3 minutes. If there's some kind of a tightening to it, we're not opening to it. So the way this supports our freeing ourselves is that this begins to reveal to us the ways that we operate that are sometimes not seen. The habits of mind that we operate through that just are sometimes not known or understood. And it's like, you know, taking off these veils, multiple veils. And at some point through this process, we can see really clearly. And we understand the nature of experience as it is, as it really is, without our views about it, without our ideas about it, just the experience happening. And that is freedom. It's freedom when we're just with what is. There's no need for anything to change. No need for you to be anything or do anything. In a moment, just now, you know, can you imagine what it would be like not to want anything to be different? How would that feel? Oh, it's kind of like, phew. Everything's okay. Things are okay as they are. No, actually, that was pretty much it, so...
Well, what if you think there's a conflict in your life and it appears to you to be caused by the attitude of someone else who's in your life? How far do you go out to that person, or should you focus on, you know, analyzing yourself and your own reaction?
Okay, so the question is, I'll paraphrase it, and if we get another question, let's use the mics, because I think there's some people that need the sound system. So your question is that you're struggling or suffering because of somebody else's attitude, and should you point it out to them or just work with yourself, and where's the balance there between just dealing with what is and actually taking some action to try to change something? Is that the question? That's a great question, because the teaching often has this flavor, or people interpret it as having this flavor of, you just sit back and the practice is to just sit back and let the world be, and you don't do anything, you just sit there. And that's not actually what the teaching is. But the teaching is to be able to understand where you're coming from. Because if you are in that kind of a situation, you know, you see somebody with a particular attitude, perhaps about you or perhaps about a situation, and you see that there's suffering. This person is doing things in the environment that impacts you, and you see perhaps that their view is not clear about the situation. The thing that's important in terms of our own spiritual practice is that we get very clear on whether we are responding to the situation out of greed, aversion, or delusion, or are we responding to the situation out of balance of mind? Are we responding to the situation out of compassion, of kindness, of generosity, of caring? It's possible in that kind of situation to respond from either perspective. I can imagine a situation where there's this situation where there's somebody who's got a particular attitude, and it's impacting you, and it's frustrating you, and it's making you angry, and it's, you know, it's causing you suffering, so you're angry about that. You could respond to that person out of anger. Or you could recognize, this person isn't seeing clearly. This person is causing suffering for themselves and for everyone around them. And out of compassion for that person, acting in a way to help them understand what's happening. Now that's challenging. That's challenging. And most of us, this practice is really about starting where we are, you know. So a lot of it will be, okay, you're looking through these glasses of knowing that you're frustrated and seeing that and yet not being able to necessarily take them off and see them and then act out of this completely beautiful, pure motivation of compassion and generosity and kindness. Most of the time, we're going to have mixed motivations. But if you can see that you're frustrated and try at least to call up some of the more wholesome qualities in response, that will slowly, slowly, slowly guide you more in the direction of those wholesome qualities. Also, one of the teachings around this has to do with wise speech and understanding when you speak that there's a time for speaking, and there's so that it's like the Buddha recommends that we speak what's true and that we recognize whether this is an appropriate time for saying this, whether it's beneficial. So that those are helpful guidelines for us. If somebody is in a state where they're not going to hear what you say in that moment, that might not be the time to talk to them about it. So to contemplate those things as well, you know, okay, this person's in a state right now. Maybe tomorrow, let's set up a time to talk and let's kind of, when that person has cooled off a bit or something, so that there's some skillfulness in the approaching of the difficult situation. Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, and it's an exploration for us, you know. We're not perfect, we're not fully enlightened, and we are going to be operating out of these unskillful attitudes. But at least recognizing that we're operating out of the unskillful attitudes is a step in the right direction. So it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention. May you enjoy exploring your relationship to your experience. Thank you.